Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We go to Numbers chapter 8. We're reading from chapter 8 through chapter 12. This is a section as far as, because we had just completed the anointing of the altar, so dedication of the altar, and actually on with life, how Book of Numbers continues on with what happens within their culture, what happens with people, and how they have issues of complaining. We all got issues. So, Numbers, chapter 8. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and say to him, when you kindle the lamps toward the face of the menorah, shall be seven lamps casting light." Aaron did so toward the face of the menorah. He kindled his lamps, as the Lord commanded Moses. This is the workmanship of the menorah, hammered out gold from its base to its flower. It is hammered out, according to the vision the Lord has showed Moses. So he made the menorah. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the Levites from among the children of Israel and purify them. So shall you do to them to purify them. Sprinkle upon them water of purification, and let them pass a razor over their entire flesh, and let them immerse their garments, and they shall become pure. They shall take a young bull and its meal offering, fine flour mixed with oil, and a second young bull shall you take as a sin offering. You shall bring the Levites before the tent of meeting, and you shall gather together the entire assembly of the children of Israel. You shall bring the Levites before the Lord, and the children of Israel shall lean their hands upon the Levites. Aaron shall wave the Levites as a wave service before the Lord from the children of Israel, and they shall remain to perform the service of the Lord. Levites shall lean their hands upon the heads of the bulls. You shall make one a sin offering and one a burnt offering to the Lord, to provide atonement for the Levites. You shall stand the Levites before Aaron and before his sons, and wave them as a wave service for the Lord. So shall you separate the Levites from among the children of Israel, and the Levites shall remain mine. Thereafter Levites shall come to serve the tent of meeting. You shall purify them, you shall wave them as a wave service, presented are they to me from among the children of Israel, in place of the first issue of every womb. The firstborn of every one of the children of Israel I have taken to myself. For every firstborn of the children of Israel became mine of man and livestock on the day that I struck every firstborn in the land of Egypt. I sanctified them all to myself. I took the Levites in place of every firstborn among the children of Israel. Then I assigned the Levites to be presented to Aaron and his sons from among the children of Israel to perform the service of the children of Israel in the tent of meeting, and to provide atonement for the children of Israel, so that there will not be a plague among the children of Israel when the children of Israel approach the sanctuary. Moses, Aaron, and the entire assembly of children of Israel did to the Levites according to everything the Lord had commanded Moses about the Levites. So did the children of Israel do to them. The Levites purified themselves and immersed their garments, and Aaron waved them as a wave service before the Lord, and Aaron provided atonement for them to purify them. Afterwards, Levites came to perform their service at the tent of meeting, before Aaron and before his sons, as the Lord had commanded Moses. So did the Levites, so they did for them. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "This shall apply to Levites from 25 years of age and up. He shall join the legion of the service of the tent of meeting. From 50 years of age, he shall withdraw from the legion of work and no longer work. He shall minister with his brethren in the tent of meeting to safeguard the charge, but work shall he not perform. So shall you do the Levites concerning their charge." Chapter 9. The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the second year from their exodus to the land of Egypt, in the first month, saying, "The children of Israel shall make the Pesach offering in its appointed time. On the 14th day of this month, the afternoon, you shall make it in its appointed time. According to its decrees and laws, you shall make it." Moses spoke to the children of Israel to make the Pesach offering. And they made the Pesach offering in the first month on the 14th day of the month in the afternoon. in the wilderness of Sinai, according to everything the Lord had commanded Moses, so the children of Israel did. There were men who had been contaminated by a human corpse and could not make the Pesach offering on that day. So they approached Moses and Aaron on that day. Those men said to him, "We are contaminated through a human corpse. But why should we be diminished by not offering the Lord's offering in its appointed time among the children of Israel?" Moses said to them, "Stand by, and I will hear what the Lord will command you." The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, if any man will become contaminated through a human corpse or will be on a distant road, whether you or your future generations, he shall make the Pesach offering for the Lord in the second month on the 14th day in the afternoon. They shall make it with matzot and bitter herbs. They shall eat it. They shall not leave over from it till morning, nor shall they break a bone of it. Like all the decrees, the Pesach offering shall they make it. But a man who is pure and was not on the road and had refrained from making the Pesach offering, that soul shall be cut off from its people. For he had not offered the Lord's offering in its appointed time. That man will bear his sins. When a convert shall dwell with you, and he shall make a Pesach offering to the Lord, according to the decree of the Pesach offering and its law, so shall he do. One decree shall be for you, the proselyte and the native of the land." On the day the tabernacle was set up, the cloud covered the tabernacle, and that was in a tent for the meeting. That was a tent for the testimony. And in the evening there would be upon the tabernacle like a fiery appearance until morning. So it would always be. The cloud would cover it, and the appearance of fire at night. And whenever the cloud was lifted from atop the tent, afterwards the children of Israel would journey. And the place where the cloud would rest, there the children of Israel would encamp. According to the word of the Lord would the children of Israel journey, and according to the word of the Lord would they encamp. All the days that the cloud would rest upon the tabernacle, they would encamp. When the cloud lingered upon the tabernacle many days, the children of Israel would maintain the charge of the Lord and would not journey. Sometimes the cloud would be upon the tabernacle for a number of days. According to the word of the Lord, would they encamp, or according to the word of the Lord, would they journey. Sometimes the cloud would remain from evening until morning, and the cloud would be lifted up in the morning, and they would journey. For a day and a night, and the cloud would lift, and they would journey. Or for 2 days, or a month, or a year. When the cloud would linger over the tabernacle resting upon it, the children of Israel would encamp, and would not journey. But when it was lifted up, they would journey. According to the word of the Lord, would they encamp. According to the word of the Lord, would they journey. The charge of the Lord would they safeguard, according to the word of the Lord, through Moses. Chapter 10. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Make for yourselves 2 silver trumpets. Make them of hammered out work. They should be yours for the summoning of the assembly and to cause the camps to journey. When they sound a long blast with them, the entire assembly shall assemble to you, the entrance of the tent of meeting. If they sound a long blast with just one, the leaders shall assemble to you, the heads of Israel's thousands. When you sound short blasts, the camps resting to the east shall journey. When you sound short blasts a second time, the camps resting to the south shall journey. Short blasts shall they sound for their journeys. When you gather together the congregation, you shall sound a long blast, but not a short blast. The sons of Aaron, the Kohanim, shall sound the trumpets, and it shall be for you an eternal decree for your generations. When you go to wage war in your land against an enemy who oppresses you, you shall sound short blasts of the trumpets. You shall recall, and you shall be recalled before the Lord your God, and you shall be saved from your foes. On the day of your gladness, and upon your festivals, and on your new moons, you shall sound the trumpet over your burnt offerings, over your peace offerings. They shall be remembrance for you before the Lord. I am the Lord, your God. It was the second year in the second month of the 20th day of the month the cloud was lifted from upon the tabernacle of testimony. The children of Israel journeyed on their journeys from the wilderness of Sinai, and the cloud rested in the wilderness of Paran. They journeyed for the first time at the bidding of the Lord through Moses. The banner of the camp of the children of Judah journeyed first according to their legions. Over its legion was Nachshon, son of Abinadab. Over the legion of the tribe of children of Issachar was Nathanael, son of Zohar. Over the legion of the tribe of the children of Zebulun was Eliab, son of Helon. The tabernacle then was taken down, and then journeyed the sons of Gershon, sons of Merari, the bearers of the tabernacle. Then journeyed the banner of the camp of Reuben, according to their legions. Over its legion was Elizur, son of Shedur. over the legion of the tribe of Simeon was Shemuel, son of Zurishaddai. Over the legion of the tribe of the children of Gad was Eliasaph, son of Deuel. Then journeyed Kohathites, bearers of the sanctuary, and they would erect the tabernacle before their arrival. Then journeyed the banner to the camp of the children of Ephraim, according to their legions. Over its legion was Elishama, son of Amminhud. Of the legion of the tribe of Manasseh was Gamaliel, son of Pedazur. And over the legion of the tribe of Benjamin was Abidan, son of Gedoni. Then journeyed the banner of the camp of the children of Dan, the rear guard of all the camps. According to the legions, over its legion was Ahizir, son of Amishaddai. Over the legion of the tribe of Ashur was Pagil, son of Achran. Over the legion of the tribe of the children of Naphtali was Ahira, son of Enan. These were the journeys the children of Israel according to legions, and they journeyed. Moses said to Hobab, son of Reuel, the Midianite father-in-law of Moses, "We are journeying to the place of which the Lord has said, 'I shall give to you.' Go with us. We shall treat you well. For the Lord has spoken good for Israel." And he said to him, "I shall not go. Only to my own land and my family shall I go." And Moses said, "Please do not forsake us, as much as you know our encampments in the wilderness, and you have been as eyes for us. And it shall be that if you come with us, then with the goodness of which the Lord will benefit us, we will do good to you." So they journeyed from the mountain of the Lord a 3 days' distance. In the Ark of the Covenant, the Lord journeyed before them 3 days' distance to search out for them a resting place. The cloud of the Lord was over them by day when they journeyed from the camp. When the ark would journey, Moses said, "Arise, Lord, let your foes be scattered. Let those who hate you flee from you before you." When it would rest, he would say, "Reside tranquilly, O Lord, among the myriad thousands of Israel." Chapter 11. The people took to seeking complaints. It was evil in the ears of the Lord, and the Lord heard, and his wrath flared. The fire of the Lord burned against them, and it consumed at the edge of the camp. The people cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. He named that place Taberah, conflagration, for the fire of the Lord had burned against them. The rabble that was among them cultivated a craving. The children of Israel also wept once more and said, "Who will feed us meat? Remember the fish we ate in Egypt, free of charge, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. But now our life is parched. There is nothing. We have nothing to anticipate but the manna." Now, the manna was like coriander seed. Its color was like the color of bedillah. The people would stroll to and gather it and grind it in a mill or pound it in a mortar and cook it in a pot or make it into cakes. Its taste was like the taste of dough kneaded with oil. When the dew descended upon the camp at night, the manna would descend upon it. Moses heard the people weeping in their family groups, each one at the entrance of his tent, and the wrath of the Lord flared greatly. In the eyes of Moses, it was bad. Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you done evil to your servant? Why have I not found favor in your eyes? Did you place the burden of this entire people on me? Did I conceive this people? Did I give birth to it? That you say to me, 'Carry them in your bosom,' as a nurse carries a suckling, to the land that you swore to its forefathers? Where shall I get meat to give the entire people when they weep to me, saying, 'Give us meat that we may eat'? I alone cannot carry this nation. It is too heavy for me. And if this is how you will deal with me, then kill me now. If I have found favor in your eyes, let me not see my evil." The Lord said to Moses, "Gather to me 70 men, the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people and its officers. Take them to the tent of meeting, and have them stand there with you. I will descend and speak with you there. I will increase some of the spirit that is upon you, and place it upon them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you, and you shall not bear alone. To the people you shall say, 'Prepare yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat.' But you have wept in the ears of the Lord, saying, 'Who will feed us meat? For it was better for us in Egypt.' So the Lord will give you meat, and you will eat. Not for a day you shall eat, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days or 20 days, until an entire month of days comes out your nose and becomes nauseating to you, because you have rejected the Lord who is in your midst. You have wept before him, saying, 'Why did we leave Egypt?'" Moses said, 600,000 foot soldiers are the people in whose midst I am, and yet you say, I shall give them meat, and they shall eat for a month of days? Can sheep and cattle be slaughtered for them all and suffice them? For if all the fish of the sea would be gathered for them, would it suffice for them? The Lord said to Moses, Is the hand of the Lord short? Now you will see whether my word comes to pass or not. Moses left and spoke the words of the Lord to the people, and he gathered 70 men from among the elders of the people and had them stand around the tent. The Lord descended in a cloud and spoke to them, and he increased some of the spirit that was upon him and gave it to 70 men. The elders, with the spirit was rested on them, they prophesied, but did not do so again. Now two men remained behind at the camp. The name of one was Eldad, the name of the other was Medad. The spirit rested upon them, and they had been among the recorded ones. But they had not gone out to the tent, and they prophesied at the camp. The youth ran and told Moses, and he said, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of Moses since his youth, spoke up and said, My lord Moses, incarcerate them. Moses said to him, Are you being zealous for my sake? Would that the entire people of the Lord be prophets, that the Lord would be place his spirit upon them. Moses was brought to the camp, he and the elders of Israel. A wind went forth from the Lord and blew quail from the sea and spread them over the camp, a day's journey this way and a day's journey that way, all around the camp, 2 cubits above the face of the earth. The Lord rose up that day and all that night, the next day, and gathered up the quail. The one with the least gathered 10 omers, and they spread them out around the camp. The meat was still between their teeth, not yet chewed. When the wrath of the Lord flared against the people, the Lord struck a very mighty blow against the people. He named that place Kibroth Hattaavah, because they buried the people who had been craving. From Kibroth Hattaavah, the people journeyed to Hatzeroth, and they remained in Hatzeroth. Chapter 12. Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses regarding the Cushite woman he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. They said, Was it only to Moses the Lord spoke? Did not speak to us as well? And the Lord heard. Now, the man Moses was exceedingly humble, more than any other person on the face of the earth. The Lord said suddenly to Moses, to Aaron, and to Miriam, You three, go out the tent of meeting. And the three of them went out. The Lord descended a pillar of cloud, and stood at the entrance of the tent. He summoned Aaron and Miriam. The two of them went out. He said, Hear now my words. If there should be prophets among you, in a vision I, the Lord, make myself known to him. In a dream shall I speak with him. Not so is my servant Moses. My entire house, he is the trusted one. Mouth to mouth do I speak with him, in a clear vision and not in riddles. At the image of the Lord does he gaze. Why did you not fear to speak against my servant Moses? The wrath of the Lord flared up against them, and he left. The cloud had departed atop the tent, and behold, Miriam was afflicted with Tzaraath, like snow. Aaron turned to Miriam, and behold, she was afflicted with Tzaraath. Aaron said to Moses, I beg you, my lord, do not cast a sin upon us. We have been foolish, and we have sinned. Let her not be like a corpse, like one who leaves his mother's womb with half its flesh being half consumed. Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, Please, God, heal her now. The Lord said to Moses, Were her father to spit in her face, would she not be humiliated for 7 days? Let her be quarantined outside the camp for 7 days, and then she may be brought in. So Miriam was quarantined outside the camp for 7 days, and the people did not journey until Miriam was brought in. Then the people journeyed from Hatzeroth, and they encamped in the wilderness of Paran. A lot of reading. Before I go my little spiel or my details of some of the subject matter in this chapter, are there comments or questions, things that caught your attention I can answer for you?
You had to take down that tent if it was only up for a day or 2 days,
yes.
Or 3 days. I mean, they were doing nothing but taking that tent up and down.
If you're journeying.
Yes.
it is a lot of work, but if you recall, the way the tent was constructed, it was designed to be attached and unattached quickly. So there were rings and loops, there were bars that put it together. It was self-standing on its frame. Don't get it wrong. Yeah, I realize. They were gold-plated wood beams. No matter how lightweight you can imagine them, it's gold-plated wood beams. I mean, those of you who built tents, right? You've assembled tents before. We did it for the wedding tent before. It takes a lot of force, a lot of strength to build one up. Now, a lot of people. Now, that is a well-engineered setup tent with, you know, spring-loaded clips and things that you all attach and other little attachments, Allen wrenches, tools. They didn't have any of that. So all you really hope for is a whole lot of men. But many hands make light work. So it is a task. Yes, Louise.
I'm impressed about how organized everything is. God is always organized. 600,000 men and or wives and or children and the animals, blah, blah, blah. And they all moved.
A mass of people.
Right.
Yep.
Even if you don't believe in God, no human person could do that.
And on top of that, you've got essentially you have Moses, you have Aaron, his two sons, two remaining sons, and now 70 elders, all moving that mass of people. So yeah, 74 people. Good luck. we can't even get you know Santa Rosa to move 74 people, and that's a small fraction of the number of people. It is a lot of people. It is a lot of people to mass to move around. Any questions or comments regarding this section so far? They're finally moving. Yes, the journey. They get to journey. They're stuck there for a year or near to it. Not quite a year. Just shy of one. About 10 months or so. 9 months. All right. No more comments. We'll go into my little spiel for the day. My marker going up here. All right, so the previous sections, which Jeff had covered last week, it was discussing, or amongst many things, the tail end of it talked about the dedication of the altar, which was all the various tribes. Each of the 12 tribes came in, they had their offering to give of the animals and the carts and everything else they were giving, in order to dedicate the altar that had just been completed. You would notice, I'm sure, in that list, Levi was not included. The tribe of Levi did not bring any gifts to the altar's dedication. They were supposed to. Now, there's a lot of reasons why. The dominant reason is they have no possession, and they're supposed to be receiving the gifts. They're the recipients. You don't give yourself a gift. It's actually money laundering today. They give yourself a gift, it's a type of money laundering. They don't do that. So Levi was not included in the gift-giving process. However, they are included in this section of chapter 8 as it introduces what their role is. The Levites, of course, were supposed to be, as they were singled out in chapter 5, as far as being the firstborn, that did the math, as far as who was firstborn and how many Levites there are and all that stuff. This is where the Levites get to come in, and this is where their task shows up. Now, it starts out, of course, as Aaron kindling the menorah. Now, there's a lot of reasons why people think it's in there, but to me, it's relatively self-explanatory. Chapter 8, after all the altar is dedicated, I'm drawing up here, or right up here. So the altar is dedicated, all the animals, all the sacrifice has been done, it's been set aside, it's now great, it's wonderful, it's up for use, it's functional. Then, God's eyes open. Remember that the menorah is the symbolic representation of the eyes of God. That's what it is. Zechariah explains it very extensively. Revelation also reiterates the same cycle, same process. The menorah, the seven candles, are supposed to represent the eyes of God. So before the altar is dedicated, the eyes of God are closed. Once the altar is dedicated, the eyes of God are now open to look and observe and examine. Because what is the function of that altar? What goes on that altar? The altar is where your sins and where your offerings are given up and offered up to God. That's its function. The altar has its task. That's what it's designed for. So God's not going to look at you, examine you, look at your offering until after the altar's ready. Now you've got your altar, you lift your offering up, you've now given to God what you have. Now God says, now I will look at you. You have my full attention. That's what the point is, the symbolism behind it. So when you receive the altar, now it's ready to use. We can now offer offerings. People, the sins can now be covered up or paid for. Various other gifts can be offered. Now God's opened his eyes. He's going to watch and see who the person offering this gift is, who you are, what your offering is, and what you need. So altar today, the only altar we have is altar of prayer that's physically offered up to us, which is technically an altar of incense. Not exactly. It's a slight off topic, but I'll talk to you just briefly. On the altar, typically what you would offer would be animals. We'll just separate that. So animals were typically offered. Now, the animals have their symbolic function. Each animal has its own representation of meaning something. One thing or another makes a difference. They all have their own function. Now, this is not to be confused with the incense altar. The incense altar is where the prayers go. That's what that symbolism is about, incense and the fragrant prayers and the smoke. That's the incense, where prayers go. Animals don't go there, and prayers don't go with the animals. They're separate. Animals are what you are, what your strength is. So, for example, the young calf or young bull or young goat or young sheep, that is your strength. I say the word strength because it's mujer, which means young. The bulker is the bursting forth energy. It's what the word means. The morning is called bulker. The opening of a river flood is called bulker. It's the bulker, the strength of something. So young animals are offered up, and they have their own functional applications. So cows, or cattle, I should say, were typically reserved for those of somewhat authority. That's its function. Meaning, so you have leadership, you have the Levites themselves, you have groups of bodies, large people, large peoples in general. That's its function, the cattle. You also have the sheep and goats, birds, rams. Well, rams, we include in the goat section, or the sheep section. The altar also consumed other things too. Your grain offerings. And if there was one, not every sacrifice had this, but a drink offering as well. Now, the drink offering dominant was poured out, typically either on, near, or at the altar, or next to the altar, on the process. So each of these various animals had their specific amount of drink or grain offering, depending on what you were trying to do. These represent people themselves, what your objective is. Now, I'm not going to go through every symbolism of every animal. That's exhaustive, and I don't have all the answers, so I couldn't answer all of them. But it doesn't regard, it's regardless whether you're rich, the cattle, or poor, which the birds fall into, all of those offerings which you're giving to God, such that God will bless you for whatever it is. Whether it be for a sin you're covering, you're taking care of. Or whether it be for I need more of this, my child needs that. Whatever God, whatever blessing you're after, those offerings are for that function. Sheep and goats, I won't go into all the symbolism again today, but they typically for the middle of the road expensive people. They're not quite as costly as cattle, but of course more so than birds, based on what you can offer. If you offered less than what you can afford, you expect a great blessing. You wouldn't, would you? You recall the widow with the mites, right? Though the person next to her may have given more or the same, she gave far more because it was the most she could possibly do. Therefore, her blessing from in God's eyes would be greater. It is designed to show or demonstrate, this is what I am. This is all the blessing you've given to me, Father. Here is my offering up, if assuming it's a burnt offering by free will, not a sin. Offering up to God, this is what I am. This is all I have, what God has built, what you have built to me. I'm giving up to you, such that you will continue to bless me exceedingly. Now, if I can, let's say I'm a multi-billionaire. You know what? Here's a turtle dove. Am I expecting a great blessing from God? No. Am I doing an offering? Yes. I'm still offering. Will God listen to my prayers? Probably. Am I expecting to bless me as a result? Probably not. That's God's decision, not mine. But the point is that it is based on who you are, what you can afford, and what your application is. So these, the animals, are that's functions. The altar has that purpose, not the incense altar, but the animal altar. And this is its application. Make sense? Yes, Jeff.
Well, you see the teaching there with that in Romans 12, 1 and 2, where it talks about, you know, offering your whole bodies as a living sacrifice and talks about renewing your mind. So it's about giving your whole self over. And the thing about giving an offering that's kind of under your resources, it's kind of what Paul's point is that, you know, go all in.
Right.
Don't hold something back. And you see that later in the prophets, where they rail against. You're bringing in, you know, diseased animals,
the ones you wouldn't eat
stuff. Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, and you think God's not going to notice this.
Right. You're expecting blessings. Of course I can get blessings. You get as they got, which was condemnation and people coming over to take over the territory. So, okay. So at the altars sanctified, dedicated, God's eyes now open. Now he'll examine all of the very offerings you wish to give. That explains the altar's function and why the menorah's lights are now on. And you recall, menorah has a front and a back. Our menorahs today have all sides. the menorah, God's designed menorah, which is not explicitly, there's no picture given on purpose. It actually has a face that you can face things and a face which you can't face things. And so the design was intent for it to look at the altar and look at the showbread table. So it actually has little cups backside to look one direction. That's its function. So that's the menorah is now on. In other words, it's saying the temple God's open for business. No way of wording it. That's how we start out. So after that, of course, then we have to say, all right, now it's open for business. Who gets to work there? Well, we already know Levite's job. That's their task. So, of course, after Aaron kindled the flame, the Levites didn't have a function. All right, we need people to do this work. We can't just do it by just the Aaron and his two sons and Moses. They have a lot more efforts that goes into that. So the Levites function, as a tribe or a whole, their tribe, they have a task. It's not too much different than the high priest's function, which stands as an intercessor, someone in between you and God. That's the high priest's task. But Levite tribe as a whole is that task for the Israelite people as a whole. Their job is to stand as an intercessor between them and God. God's goal or objective, which he spells out in verse, was it 19? I think it was verse 19. To provide, the latter half of verse 19, presented them to provide atonement for the children of Israel so that a plague will not be among the children of Israel when the children of Israel approach the sanctuary. The goal of Levites is to literally be the shield in between the children of Israel and God. That's their job. Levite tribe is that offering, is that shield, is that separator. No different than the high priest, of course, Messiah is a separator as well from us, between us and God. The Levite tribe as a whole was that. But I want to bring something out to you in particular. The Levite tribes themselves, they are the offering. That is the offering of the people of Israel. Yeah, we think, well, there's cows, there's sheep, there's goats, yada, yada. Those are animals. The spiritual function of Levites and being offered in this way is to represent that they are the actual true offering of Israel. They are the strength. They are its best. That's the point of a firstborn. It's supposed to be the best. Hopefully. The best is the firstborn. That's the offering was supposed to be that way. And God had killed the best in Egypt. So in the way that the Levites, God had killed the firstborn and took the firstborn as his own, the Levites are the offering that God is receiving. That's explained very well in this chapter as it discusses the symbolism of what's happening. After they've already taken their various bowls, they got the two calves together with the grain offerings and the drink offering, the sin offering. This is verse 5. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, take the Levites from among the children of Israel and purify them. So shall you do to them to purify them. Sprinkle upon them water of purification. Stop there for a moment. What is water of purification? Certain kind of mikveh. Ah, yes. Red heifer. I can never spell heifer. E-I-E or E-I? Is it E-I or I-I? I before E, right? E-I. See, I before E. Or a neighbor and way. Is heifer? A? No. It's English. It's all screwy. The red heifer mixed with water. Now, this mixture... Oh, sorry. Your hand was up. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just had a thought for today. It's kind of way out there, but it's just a thought. Is that God is preparing his priesthood today because we are a gift to his son, and we will be that priesthood for Christ in the kingdom. So he's building his priesthood today. He's not calling everybody today, but he is building his priesthood, and we will be presented to Christ as the bride, right?
It's a lot of things, but yes.
So we are a gift to his son, and then we will be working with him in the kingdom. Is that not?
That's a task. That's the symbolism. No, that's the symbolism. That's part of how the symbolism works. So Levites, of course, they have to be purified with red heifer water. Now, the red heifer water is not explained until Numbers 19, which obviously it's a little bit later than Numbers 8. However, they already knew about it in Numbers 8. Yes.
You said that God took the best, you mean, of the cattle? Then you said
the firstborn is symbolically the best.
Right.
Firstborn equals best. That's the symbolism. Throughout all planet Earth, firstborn is considered the best. First fruit's the best. As far as God's concerned, the first is the best. It's symbolically, God took the firstborn of Egypt by killing them. Cattle and human. Killed them all. Taking them by sanctifying them. The first fruit of Egypt was wiped out. And he explains it a couple of times here. That in that process, by killing the firstborn of Egypt, he sanctified, which means set aside, all the firstborn of Israel as belonging to him, as payment, so to speak. It's a process of how God's going to work. It's kind of a trade-off. One dies for the other one to live. That's how the process is going to work. Yeah, the firstborn of Egypt died, so the firstborn of Israel could live. Or actually, Israel, the whole of Israel could live. But the firstborn of Israel now have a job. They have a responsibility that went with that. That's supposed to symbolically mean the best. Now, our firstborns may or may not be the best. That's practical. That's a physical thing. But symbolically, they're supposed to be the best. So when God said, all the firstborn of Israel is now mine, I purchased them through the killing of the firstborn of Egypt, in place of me taking the firstborn of all your children, I'm going to take the entire tribe of Levi is mine. And you can keep your firstborn kids. Women and men.
Are the women firstborn too?
Not traditionally, but that I won't say it isn't the case.
Okay.
Traditionally, it's first.
Traditionally,
it'd be firstborn males because women were not typically allowed to serve in the capacity that this was done. However, one could argue that it's debatable whether it would include first women as well. Right. We're not in Christ in this application. This is regarding the Torah, so it doesn't necessarily specify. The term "children of Israel" refers to males, the masculine term, masculine Hebrew word. Now, the problem is that masculine words, feminine words, we're doing groups of people. They're all inclusive, so it's really kind of screwy. Masculine apply to groups of male, also applies to groups of male and female mix. So it's just how most languages work. So it's very difficult to say for certain. However, when Levi was counted out a few chapters earlier, they had the exact number as far as what it was set up for. It was supposed to be males that were 30 and up were counted. I think it was 30, 20. I forgot. It's something that it's 20 and up. I think it's 20. Whatever it was, I've forgotten. Yeah, 30 for Levi, they had a different threshold of ages. We'll discuss that shortly, because it comes up again in chapter 9. So these separations are happening. God has set aside these individuals. And the Levites, they have a process. First process is red heifer water. Now, red heifer water, which is discussed in Numbers 19, we'll get to there today, basically is designed to cleanse someone from a contamination, a corpse of some form. You use your corpse of a human, but you can corpse of an animal as well. Anybody who has been contaminated at some point in their life through a dead person, that doesn't necessarily mean touch the dead body. That means if you're in the same house and the person dies, you're contaminated too. If you're in the same room, if you enter it any time when there's a dead body in the room, you're contaminated too. That's spelled out in the Nazirite as well, which happened, Nazirite vow, which was in the chapter, I want to say 6, is all spelled out in chapter 19. It is the proximity of death that contaminates everybody in the room. Yes.
Kind of tells you something about, I've been studying a lot of Eastern Orthodox history and tradition lately, and they talk about all these churches that they established, and they would actually put the bones of dead people right in the middle of the church.
Exactly.
So begs the question, you walk into that church and there's a dead body, even though it's just bones, there's really no flesh anymore.
Right.
Under that altar, when you walk into that church, it is the home, so to speak, of a dead body, maybe more dead bodies.
Yep,
who knows?
Yep.
Because later on, like in Europe, like in England, you'll find catacombs underneath churches where many, many people are buried.
Yep.
Like Westminster Abbey, there was all sorts of people buried in that place.
Yep. And yeah, it's... I won't criticize cultures, but holy cow. I won't do that. At least not knowingly. Anyway, so let's continue on here. The process of they had to wash themselves first, of course, their clothing, the water, and They had to shave themselves. Now, it says across their bodies. I don't know how extensive that is. I'm assuming by at least the Nazirite vow, it includes the whole head. The rest of the body, I don't want to go there. But whatever it was, they had to be washed. Why? Why would God want it cut off? Hair's dirty. Well, it's sort of. No, they could bathe. They could bathe, right? What's the reason? Was that newborn baby? It is, yeah, like a newborn baby, which is a lot of the symbolism there. But you can do hairs. There's a symbolism behind hair, and what God's using for. Yes,
it's a humbling thing for the person to have to do that.
It is. That's a big deal there. I didn't write down the verse, but in the story of King David, there was an event that happened. I believe the king's name was, I want to say Nashom? I forgot the king's name. Anyway, the other king from the country. David sends some men over there to console the loss of his father. What was that? Was it Moab? It was Moab. Thank you. King of Moab. So King David sent some men to Moab. I don't remember the number of men, I think like 10 or 20, I can't remember. And the advisors of the new king of Moab, because his dad just died, and David's had a good relationship with the king of Moab because they were good friends, though he was much older. So the king of Moab died, and the new king shows up, and his advisors say, hey, these men are coming from David. They're spies. Treat them like spies. They're not here to console you. Not here to make say sorry. Don't trust them. Treat them like spies. And so the king of Moab takes their clothing, cuts it in half, top to bottom, shaves half their face beard off, and then sends it back home. So they're traveling from Moab back to Israel with half their clothing and half their beard shaved off, which, of course, a great humiliation. Now, most humans would say, okay, shave the other half off, get yourself dressed, go back to work. No. In that instance, David did something what we would modern day think be strange. He told the men, go hide yourself until your beard has returned. Then you may come back and serve. So it was a humiliation to have part of you shaved off. In this case, half the beard was shaved off. I believe half the head too, but I could be wrong on that. So half his beard shaved off, that was a disgrace. So Moab disgraced the people, of course, it resulted in wars and other things, which is no big deal, that's what kings do. But the shaving off was a disgraceful thing, the act of looking shaved. But the Levites, they're doing something beyond just the shaving. But she's right as far as Pat was correct. The shaving is a humiliation process. Humble. But it has one other aspect too. When we look and read about the Nazirite vows, when Nazirite had to go into his vow, which means his service to God, what was his job? What was the first thing he had to do? Shave all the hair off your head. Shave it. Get rid of it. And throw it away. That's when you started your vow. So you were started when you had to shave your head off. That's when you were now in a Nazirite vow. Of course, no wine. There's no dead bodies. And a few other things you can't touch. I forgot all of them. They're listed in chapter, I think it's chapter 5. Or maybe 6 of Numbers. But what you must do. If for some reason, during your time of your vow, maybe you said, I'm going to dedicate my life to God for a year, or 6 months, or 5 years, whatever long it was, who makes no difference. After, maybe 10 hours. After, maybe see 2 months go by, or a year goes by, and you get contaminated. Something happens. In this case, of course, explains in the book of Numbers, the case of a corpse regarding red heifer, and happens up at that time as well, the water does. Something happens. God's instruction is shave all the hair you have grown up to this point and throw it away. Because all your previous service of a vow has now been contaminated. I am discarding that vow that you had from when you started up to the point which you got contaminated. I'm chucking it out. The hair represents that. The hair represents that vow that's been contaminated. And then continue on from that point on to complete however much time there is left on your vow. When your vow was then finished, and your time of service is up, shave it all again. But this time, don't throw it away. You will burn the hair on your altar, actually under your altar, after you, your offering that you just gave, to indicate that you have completed your vow. So in the symbolism we're seeing with the Nazirite, which the Levites are functionally doing the same thing the Nazirite vow was supposed to do, who are dedicating your life to service. The difference is Levites have their whole life. The Nazirite has some part, some piece. And the Nazirite's not from Levi, they're from some other tribe. So the Nazirite vow is a short snippet, a little snapshot of what a Levite's life is like. So this whole process, the Levite, the shaving of the head, the shaving of the beard, shaving of the body, the Levite gets the whole body at least, or at least most of it, that hair represents something to God. It represents, at least in the case of the Nazirite, your contamination, the stuff he doesn't want. As Dave pointed out, you're like a newborn. You're clean. Start over again. Although some newborns are born with hair, most aren't. You start over. You start from scratch. You're clean. As a newborn child, you enter the kingdom of God. That's whole. It's the symbols behind that. Most whole body. So that's how that process is supposed. That's the symbolism behind here. So Levite has to wash himself, has to shave himself. He is now completely new. All started from ground zero. Start from beginning again. So make sense so far? That's the physical stuff Levite's got to do. Beyond the fact of being waved. We'll discuss the waving in a minute. There's one other part that's, though it's described physically here, it is a spiritual concept. The laying on of hands. So the next task for Levites, after God is all cleaned up, they get the hands laid on. Now the hands, of course, all is supposed to be the children of Israel, lays their hands on it. I don't believe every human in Israel laid their hands on a Levite. The most likely it could have been leadership doing it, or some certain numbers of people doing it. I don't know how many actually physically touched them, but at least they tried, some symbolically. We do that today in some ways in our culture. We're laying on hands. We don't physically have to touch a person. We kind of just lift our hand up and they're kind of pointing at the general direction. The same principle, idea. So laying on of hands for the children of Israel. So children, I'm going to abbreviate, of Israel, lay hands on Levites. Now the Levites then, of course, lay hands on the cows. Okay, calves. So Israel lays hands on Levites. Levites lay hands on the calves. The calves are offered as a sin offering and a burnt offering. Doing the basic symbolism, you know, A equals B, B equals C, then A equals C. If the laying on the hands of Israel on Levites sanctifies them or sets aside, you are now the servants or offering to God, which God's going to use you as laborers for all of Aaron and his sons, which all the descendants thereof. The calves are the same symbol. So therefore, the Levites, it's children you're offering the Levites, the same as the Levites offering the calves. Therefore, the Levites are the offering to God. It's a pretty obvious set, nothing complicated about that. But that's the symbols behind it. So Levites are the children of Israel's offering, as the chapter here explains. Does that make sense to anybody so far? Now we go to a little tidbit of strangeness. Verse 23 of chapter, sorry, 24 of chapter 8. It says, this shall apply for Levites from 25 years of age and up. He shall join the legion of the service of the tent of meeting. From 50 years, he shall withdraw from the legion of work, no longer working. He shall minister with his brethren until the meeting to safeguard the charge, but the work he shall not perform. You shall do to the Levites concerning their charge. Now, it's odd because previously, chapter 5, it's when it's such setting aside the individual families as far as their individual ages. The Levites, okay, so the Merari and Kohath and Gershom, the three Levite tribes, we draw over here. These three groups of Levites, their work at the tent of meeting, tearing it down, rebuilding it, offering sacrifices, doesn't start until they're 30 years old. That's where they start working. But yet, here it says quite plainly, they start their work at 25. What are they doing for 5 years? They're learning. It's a task, an apprenticeship. Now we think, well, how complicated could it possibly be? Probably a lot. It's a really big tent. It takes some effort to do it right. So for 5 years during the process of an apprenticeship. So they start at 25, basically just learning how to do things for 5 years. So they get to go through five sets of holy days, at least multiple times which they travel, and then at least also all different offerings that come for five seasons of animals who are birthed and new calves come, everything happens and people offer their offerings. They have to see what's going on. So then they start their work at 30 and they end it at 50. So the 50-year-olds basically teach 25-year-olds how to do the job. Well, practical presence what's happening. And they reach so that you only serve in the temple for basically 20 years and you're done. Go do something else. In this case, it's teaching. But they have to keep the charge. All right, AR. What is the charge then? What is the charge they're supposed to do? What are they keeping? They keep the tent of meeting. They're keeping this task going. They're keeping that offering going that they are always going to be in charge of and taken care of and work for God and Aaron. They are maintaining their offering. So this one-time offering that went to the calves for the one time the tribe of Levi, it's supposed to happen, or supposed to, sorry, equivalently be the entire tribe for all consecutive generations. It doesn't end. Which makes sense. When Messiah is the high priest, does his priestly service end? No. But all the people who work for him, their service end? No. It's their whole life, it's a never-ending cycle. He's continuously trying to build. So it takes a forever process. So all the Levites are supposed to maintain this, so this charge they're maintaining, that they will never fall short on that task. They'll always make sure that they are the offering of the children of Israel, the offering to God, both for sins and for burnt offerings. That's the job. They can do a pretty good job. Immediately following, we go into the first actual job they get to do, which is Passover. Good for them. I'm going to erase this because I don't need it right now. Chapter 9, of course, covers the Passover. So once the Levites get selected, say, okay, now you now have a job. You have a charge. You have everything else you're doing. You've been offered up. We get Passover. There's a whole lot of lambs that we offer for Passover for roughly 2.5 million people. I won't go into the details of numbers and how many people of who did what, but you got to eat a lot of lamb, you got to eat a lot of meat, a lot of animals, 2.5 million people for one day. I don't know, and it says it's a lamb per household, shared typically, so depending on the size of the household, it varies some. You're probably looking for 2.5 million, oh, I don't know, maybe 800,000 lambs? Could be a little less, a little more, give or take. That's a lot of lambs. So, I would draw it up there. But, so the tribe of Levi, all the offerings that Kohath and the high priest and Aaron, all they got to do, there's a whole lot of animals. And it happens, this process happens, supposed to happen, the animal is offered on the proper day, which is Monday. I don't want to clean up that mess. But it's going to be a horrid mess. You need a lot of water. So all the animals, that's the first task of all the Levites. They get to do a massive Passover offering for all of Israel. It's the first test of their knowledge, their skill, and what they have to do. Of course, Aaron has to be obviously in charge of all of it. Now, of course, obviously, there's the one group of people which came out at the Passover. I'm not going to go through all the Passover. You know the story of Passover, how it works. The people come out to Israel saying there's a group that were not able to keep the Passover. Now, of all the holy days, you will notice, if you look through the Torah, only one holy day is there a second one for you. You don't get a second Shabbat. You don't get a second new moon. You don't get a second trumpets or Sukkot. Those seconds. It's one-shot deal. Do it now or don't do it at all. Except Passover. Now, this is only applies to Passover. So Passover gets two. I'm drawing the line here. There are two times you're allowed to do Passover. Now, this does not apply to Days of Unleavened Bread. This is only the one day, or one evening, I should say, of Passover. So normally we have Passover, Days of Unleavened Bread for the following consecutive 7 days. Matzah. This 7 days of matzah, that is observed when it officially happens, not a month later. So for some reason, you're contaminated. You can't observe the Passover lamb the proper day it's supposed to be. Regardless of that, throw the yeast out anyway. Throw the bread out anyway. You're still observing the days of unleavened bread for the proper time, the full 7 days. That's regardless of whether you were clean for Passover or not. You still observe it then. There is no new first fruits, or another wave sheaf offering, or an extra, any of the holy days. Because if you did, then all the holy days would be duplicated along the whole path. God didn't do that. Passover was the important one. He wanted to make sure that everybody understood the Passover. If you missed it, you had to try it again the next time. To make sure every human got that. Why? What's so valuable about Passover? What about atonement? That's a great holiday, isn't it? What about, no one likes repeating atonement. What are the other holy days? What's wrong with them? Aren't they really good and really holy and really great? Yes, Tammy.
Well, it might have something to do with the fact that I think Passover is the only feast where God specifically says, if you don't show up, you will be cut off from the people. He doesn't say that about any of the other feasts that I'm aware of.
Could be. I don't remember, actually. I didn't look that up. It could be. I don't know. I've never looked it up.
So that might be why he gave a second chance for the Passover avenue. For these folks who maybe had contact with a corpse or something like that, where they could not do the Passover, but not because they were willfully not wanting to do it. They had a legitimate reason not to participate in it.
Right. That's possible. I had not looked that up. I didn't look at whether there was an instance which the other holy days are that way or not. I'm not sure. The element I want to focus on Passover in particular is that much like the party of the Red Sea, Passover is a holiday that has essentially nothing to do with you. Nothing to do with you. Your actions do not affect Passover. Nine. Oh, what you're referring to? Thank you. Passover itself is a holy day that is distinct. And that all the holy days require actions on your part, whether you're clean, holy, this, that, whatever. And Passover, you have to not be contaminated, obviously. But your salvation is completely independent of it. This is all God. He does all the work. You don't do jack. That's what the symbolism behind it is supposed to be. Unlike, for example, atonement, you examine yourself. Unlike, for example, first fruits, where you're trying to offer the best, you are also continuously being counted or included in that counting cycle. Unlike Sukkot, which you're dwelling with brethren, which of course you have to make sure you're doing it properly in the cycle of tent or sukkahs and holy days, offerings are done that particular day. Passover, the symbol behind Passover is to cover your sins. So Passover's job is a covering. Sorry, not covering. That's atonement. Passover's job is to conceal. It's a better word. Conceal your sins. Book seal. As if they don't exist anymore. That's not the same as atonement. Atonement's design is to take your sins away from you so you know what they are. Considering your sins, God saying, I don't see them because somebody else covered you over. In this case, a Passover lamb covered over. Your sins aren't there. That's simply, you didn't do it. Your salvation isn't part of it. So Passover is a seal of sins, but not from you. That concept is supposed to point us the idea, which, for example, in the obvious example, Messiah, when he died. He's supposed to die as a Passover lamb, right? What tasks were we supposed to do to make sure that happened? What is our responsibility to make sure that his death on the cross occurs? Nothing. You don't do anything for it. Now, you have to believe in him for it to apply to you. But that's different. That's a belief. His actions are purely his own. God set it all up to be all him. Passover is an important holiday that does that. It's supposed to symbolically be that way for us. So our actions are not supposed to affect our salvation. That's the concept of Passover. That is not the concept that applies to all of the holidays. Your actions affect how the other holidays and how God interacts with you. Passover is different. Yes.
So this is why they accuse the Jews of killing the Messiah. Why it can't be so? Because Christ laid down his own life.
Right. All by the hand of God. It was not right. All by the
everything
hand of God.
Happened, right.
Everything according to
right
to God's,
in the fullness of time.
Fullness of God's plan.
Everything down to... Okay.
So Passover is an important one. God wants to make sure that all of us understand our salvation is very, very important to him. Our sins being thrown away and covered up is very important to him. It is not the application for all of the holidays. There's other things we do for the holidays. There's Shavuot and there's the offering of things up and there's other tasks that individual people responsibility applies. Passover is a distinct one. He wanted that one, made sure that we as human beings know that it's all him. So make sure we're part of that process, that cycle. Okay? So Passover has its own duplication. Make sure that happens. So they get the Passover offering. However many thousands of sheep went up. I don't know. I didn't count them. I wasn't there. But a whole bunch. And then they get to go. I'm not going to go through all the reading of all the different applications as far as how the cloud went up and how it went down in their travels. I do want to point out one point out, though. In this cycle of Passover, it gives, in my opinion, a good contrast between the two types of people. One that cannot observe Passover, and one that can and chooses not to. That's in verse 13 and 14. It points out that the individual who has no desire or does not know of Passover, knows of but chooses not to, there is no option there. You are chucked out. As Tammy had pointed out, you're thrown away, so to speak, because you've chosen not to follow. Contrasts that the individual who says they are a sojourner or at their appointed time, they wish to offer Passover as well. That's somebody who's choosing to follow. I guess it's subtle, but to me, it's important to note that God does expect us to choose. Let's see here. Let's jump to chapter 10. Are there other things to cover today? I'm sure none... Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Bill.
That would be choosing every time it came around.
Yes. Every single year.
Every year.
Every single year.
Yeah.
Choose to follow. Chapter 10. None of you, I'm sure I wouldn't, appreciate waking up in the morning in your tent, and look out, oh no, the cloud's gone. Quick, put ourselves together. Quick, we're going to go. Having no knowledge ahead of time. It's far easier if you hear the noise, woken up by a blast, notification, hey, guess what, we're moving out. Much, much, much easier. Now, granted, in this whole process of moving out and how they travel from place to place and place, I would be much happier in the tribe of Dan and his group because I am inherently like to sleep in. I'm last to know, I'm okay. I get time to pack up my stuff and not a big deal. As opposed to the first group of Judah's, get your butt out of bed and get to work. Clean up. You're packing up, you're moving out. They get the early morning wake-up call. It's not my fan. I like to sleep in the mornings. Not as light. Yeah, which makes sense. I'm Daniel. I fit there really well. I don't need all the fanfare ahead. I'll take up the tail end. Anyway, so these three tribes, as far as they have to go out first and all these cycles of movement, and kindly enough, God decided to say, I'm going to make you some silver trumpets. Chapter 10, of course, is covered in the Feast of Trumpets, which is written up there in the little banner behind you. We cover chapter 10, discussing the details of what silver trumpets mean, what their function is, and how they symbolically do stuff, and what God wants with them. Anyone want to take a guess as what silver trumpets for? Movement is one half of it. What's the other half? Well, war is attached to movement. To talk to you. It's the blast. It's a long blast. God said, I'm going to talk to you. We have a conversation. Let's guess what's going to happen next. Whatever it may be, I don't know. But that's God's decision. So there are two different types of blasts. There's the long blast, which is split up between one trumpet doing it versus two trumpets doing it. So sometimes there's two of them. And there's the short blasts. The long and short blasts, pretty functional. They only do it two different ways. The long blast, of course, is used for if there's both trumpets being blown, the entire assembly comes together. I'm not sure what that includes. I don't think all 2.5 million people would come to the tent meeting, but at least a representative from most of them would probably come up. Maybe just the males. I'm not sure. As far as the two long blasts, but if it's a single blast, just the leadership comes up. I don't know who that all includes. I'm assuming it includes the 70 elders that were written up here before. I don't know if it includes any more than that. But at least those are designed to come. For the long blasts. To long blasts is to get your attention. I want to talk. What's short blasts for? Get your gear. You're either going to war or you're moving. Those are tasks for short blasts. Yeah. You're either going to war or you're going to move. So short blasts, they have their function as far as war and movement. And moving. Now, in long blasts, there is one other function, which is actually very similar to it in the communication style. You would do a long blast for feast days. Or new moons. It would be a long blast. Because what are feast days and new moons? They are appointed times. Moedim. What is the appointment for? God's going to talk to you. Makes sense. So you're going to use a long blast for God's calling you together to talk. It is for a meeting purpose. So long blasts would also apply for the feasts as well as new moons, that what you would do. Which it describes here, of course, the different types of blasting and how the process is supposed to work. Let's see here. It says here the short blasts, it is designed, this is verse 10. On the day of gladness and new moons and festivals, you shall sound the trumpets of your burnt offerings for your feasts, and peace offerings, and they shall be a remembrance for you before the Lord. I am the Lord your God. That's the purpose of those meetings, a remembrance for you, a communication. Now, for the first time, in verse 11, after a year and a month or two, this is the second year, in the first month of the year, on the 20th day of the month, the cloud was lifted. This is the first time the whole shebang happens. So it's been a year since they moved this way. Actually, this is the first time they ever moved this way. It's been a year since they last moved. I'm guessing at Sinai or near to it, because they arrived at Sinai near Shavuot, which would have been roughly the early part of the third month, in the first year. And so they've been hanging out there for just, this is a year in the second month, just shy of a full year. They've been hanging out at Mount Sinai. So now they get to move. Of course, the blast points out that Judah and Issachar go first. Then Gershom and Merari go second. After them, of course, is Reuben, Simeon, and Gad. And then Kohath goes after them. The cycle is supposed to break down. Is that wherever the cloud's going to go, travel off somewhere. All these tribes are traveling in this grouped pattern. So when they arrive, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, they arrive first. And then Gershom and Merari arrive. Now their job, Gershom and Merari, since they tore down the covering, the tent, the parts, all the different pieces that cover everything up, they tore it down. They're carrying that stuff. So by the time they get there, they have to have it set up and ready to go before Kohath arrives with the ark. Because you're not going to have four guys hanging out there with their shoulders, with this ark weighing on their shoulders. Oh, you guys, will you be ready? Oh, 4 more hours? Okay. They can't set it down. They have to hold it. So you'd want the place you're going to live be ready by the time you get there. Else you have to sit there and hold this thing the whole time. Because you're not allowed to touch it. You can't sit down on open dirt. You can't put it on a cart. It has to be held the whole time and carried only by people or read in its resting place in the Holy of Holies sanctuary. So Gershom and Merari, they got to get to wherever they're going and build the constructed tabernacle, at least the holy section, as quickly as they can before the next two groups arrive. Well, Reuben and Simeon, they could obviously come, but before Kohath arrives in particular. And that cycle of movement, after them, of course, follow the last six tribes of Ephraim, Manasseh, Benjamin, and Dan, Asher, and Naphtali, taking up the rear. That's the cycle of where they go and how they go. They're going from place to place to place, whether they're going for one day, a month, a year, makes a difference. Each day, that's the cycle they travel. In chapter 9, verse 21. All right. Sometimes, it's chapter 9, verse 21, which points one of their traveling times. The cloud would remain from evening till morning. The cloud would lift up in the morning. They would journey for a day and a night, and the cloud would lift up and they would journey. That implies the cloud can travel day or night. So it isn't like a daily thing necessarily. You'd be traveling nonstop for a full day and night, potentially. And hopefully you get some rest at some point in there. So anytime the traveling happened, it didn't matter if it was day or night, you just have a cloud or a pillar of fire. It would toggle between the two times, the time of days. And they get to go this whole process. So all these various leaders are in charge of it. I'm not going to rattle them all off again. They're pretty obvious how chapter 10 goes through. Here's chapter 11. So now that we've established the Levites are the people who are supposed to be intercessors. They're in between the people, children of Israel and God. They're supposed to serve them to cover atonement for them. We have how you move from place to place established. We have the process by which you communicate your movement from place to place. We have the setup or the functioning tabernacle and tent of meeting is now in full operation. What's the first thing they do? Complain. How disappointing. Granted, I'm not there, so I don't know for certain, but the eighth one, I have not been counting. So the eighth complaint on number 11, chapter 11? It could be. I never counted them. So they travel, I'm sure it probably did. So they travel approximately 3 days. So they're traveling from the Sinai Peninsula about 3 days out. So 3 days go by before complaints show up. Doesn't take them long. I'm not sure what they didn't have. We don't know what the process, what they're complaining about. In the first part of chapter 11, it does not specify what the complaint is. It says, people took to seeking complaint. It was evil in the ears of the Lord. Lord heard, his wrath was flared up. The fire of the Lord burned against them and consumed the edge of the camp. People cried out, Moses prayed to the Lord, and the Lord fire died down. He named the place Terabah, for the fire of the Lord had burned against them. Now that was complaint number one in chapter, the first few verses is a complaint. What they were complaining about, I don't know. I'm taking a wild guess. That's the second complaint. The meat is the second complaint. The first complaint isn't part of the meat, it's not part of food. Take a wild guess as far as what they just go through. 3 days of traveling. Take a guess. What are they complaining about? I can do this again. I'm traveling. What? We have to move again? Note, we already discussed this. If it is that many, 2.5 million people, it's a lot to pack up and move. You're not going to travel 20 feet or 20 miles in a day. Yeah, I don't get 20 feet, honestly. By the time the day is full, the sun set, the last people are finally packing up their stuff, ready to go. Yeah. So you didn't get anywhere. The last guys get there, by the time the sun, it's already dark. The first guys have been sleeping all night, and they're up to in the morning. So it's a little screwy as far as the process works. They traveled for 3 days. That's all they went. And they're complaining. And so the outskirts of the camp get consumed. Now, who is the outskirts? Some say it's this, some say it's that. Lollygaggers. Some would argue it's probably the guy at the tail end where I am. Dan Asher and this and Nathali complained that, what? I just got up and I had to go back. I had to move again. Possibly those guys, or it could have been somebody else. I don't know. But the point is, their first complaint occurs 3 days after traveling. Yes, Deborah.
Today, Louise had us watch Bonnie Judah, and he said it had to do with they complained about the manna.
Second complaint.
That was the second?
The second complaint is complaining about the food. The first complaint doesn't tell us what they're complaining about. The first complaint starts and ends from verse 1 to verse 3. That's complaint number 1. It starts at chapter 11, verse 1. It starts to seek complaints. It was evil in the eyes of the Lord. He heard his wrath flared up. Now, what were they complaining about? It doesn't say. Hardship of something. Whatever they were hardship about, what are they complaining? Who knows what the hardship was? And a fire of the Lord came forward. A fire, as in burning stuff, it's burning things. It comes forth against the camp and burns at the edge. People cried out. Moses prayed. The fire died down. They named the place. The bearer for the fire of the Lord burned them. That's complaint number one. Doesn't say what the complaint is. I'm guessing, since they just went through 3 days of walking, it's probably related to that. But that's just my guess. I don't know for certain. Complaint number two is the food. That starts in verse 4. The rabble that was among them cultivated a craving. The children of Israel also went once more. Who will feed us meat? Remember the fish to eat in Egypt? It was free. Cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. And now our life is parched, and nothing we have to speak but manna. That's complaint number two. God did not use fire to fix complaint number two. What did he use? Plague of birds. Drop them dead. So complaint number two, so complaint number one is they complain about something. I'm speculating it's probably the 3 days of travel they just went through. Which, yeah, one could argue if it's hard, I don't know if it's hard or easy, but that's what they, whatever they went through, I don't know. Complaint number two is the food. So they need meat. And they say they're parched. They're parched land. It implies there's no water. They didn't specify that they want water. They're saying it's a parched land, which implies there's lack of water. Yes.
And they couldn't eat the sheep and the lamb and the animals because that was set aside for sacrificial purposes?
That's not the case. An offering or sacrifice offering, the only people who would set it aside would be the actual tribe of Levi. Because they have received a certain percentage of the people's offerings. They have to weed out what's good, what's bad, depending on what the application is for tithe offerings in particular, or other offerings. When it's given up, that's usable. If it's still yours, do whatever you want with it. It's still yours. So it's not set aside. They could eat their sheep, but how many sheep does it take to feed 2.5 million?
A lot.
And no, there's no refrigeration. No deep freezers. It's, you cook it, you eat it. You might be able to dry the meat. That's it. There is no long-term preservation. You can't dig a hole in the ground and bury it as like a cellar because you're traveling all the time because you're going to leave it behind. So there is no preservation of food other than the form of drying. So slaughtering an animal for eating, its really function is you're going to eat the whole thing then. Don't not preserving it on for days and day or weeks or like we do for years in our deep freezers. Yes, Jeff.
One of the things that they were complaining about, it mentioned, is that they were in back in Egypt, they were able to eat all this stuff for free.
For free!
And
now it
how
costs
much did they
something.
Pay for the manna?
It's still
manna
free.
Was free.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Actually, I heard from a rabbi that in number five, if you pay attention, because I was cracking my head on it, it says, we remember that we ate fish free of charge. But the word ate,
uh-huh.
I mean the verb, it's in future. So I went and checked it,
mm-hmm.
and it says, we will eat. So they were planning on going back to Egypt. And it all makes sense because they're thinking about...
It's possible. Yeah, it would be what's that phrase? It's not a future perfect tense. It's a future... I forgot there's a word for it. Yes, Jeff.
Well, one of the challenging things about Hebrew is that
it's all in
is that
future.
You basically have a to get a future tense. You have a past tense verb with a vav in front of it. Then you have to guess: is it talking about past tense or future tense?
And
it's all context.
It is context. That's true. It's possible that was now to be fair. That is a reasonable assessment in that they had. Intended, because they were complaining against God about bringing them out of Egypt, to go back. That's obvious. They actually say so. They'd rather go back. And later on in the chapters, it says, let's go back. That's their intent. Whether this is a memory or a future tense, I can't prove. I couldn't say one or the other. I do want to point out that, as pointed out earlier already, free of charge. Cucumbers, melons, leeks, now, we don't know if the other ones were free of charge or not. Free of charge. I don't know how much it costs to buy those items. My guess is they grew them. Yes. Jared. Possibly, yes.
Another thing about like melons and cucumbers and leeks and onions and fish is that they're all under something. Or from
underwater?
The ground. They don't want to be taken care of God. They want to they don't want heavenly stuff. They want earthly stuff.
That's possible. I know that all those items they list require abundance of water to make them function. It's interesting. Yes.
I also kind of wonder if this is a complaint. It could kind of tie into the first complaint about the traveling.
It's possible.
Because you cannot, if you're moving around, you cannot plant anything because you're not
right.
going to be there to reap it. So why would you plant it? So
right.
I think this could also be part of the frustration of being moved around. Because they can't stay in it. They travel for 3 days. They don't know how long God's going to let them stay there. So they don't want to plant something only for God to pick them up and move.
Right.
So this could still be a frustration about being moved around. They want to be settled. They want to be able to settle down and, you know, have the foods they like to eat that they grew up on, that they've known all their lives. This manna stuff, it's called what the heck is it for a
yes.
reason.
Yes, what is that? Yes.
They are tired of the what the heck is this. They want the stuff that they know. That's just like if you go to, like, if you were to emigrate to, you know, let's say you immigrated to Kenya. You're not going to have avocados
right.
and all these things that we Californians just love. You're going right. to have cravings for those things really quickly if you go to a foreign country. And yep. you're going to long for them, and you might start grumbling and fussing and complaining. And I think that's part of what they're doing.
Yep.
They're grumbling, fussing, and complaining because they can't have those things that they grew up with.
They're accustomed with. Yep. Yep. That's just what they're after. So they're after all these things they want back. Now, this is where the Torah, in verse 7, defends manna. Because it points out that all they look forward to is the manna in verse 6. Now, this is where it defends manna. It wasn't that bad. Now, the manna was like coriander seed. Color was like the color of bedelach. The people would stroll out, gather it, grind it in mill, pound it in mortar, cook it, pot, bake the cakes, whatever. It tasted the taste of dough kneaded with oil. So it was a very rich dough. Very rich type of texture of food. That is not something to complain about. That's still a very desirable thing we have today. We call them croissants. People pay a lot of money for them. Don't smother it up with oil and butter. It tastes wonderful. So it's still a desirable item. Moses, of course, hears their weeping and complains, and Moses complains, okay, how can I feed these people? They want meat, they want water, they don't want to move, they want whatever they're complaining about. The first thing is, after a couple of days out, they complain. Complainers, complainers, complainers. Now, the first assault, the first time, the first part of chapter 11, it says God caused the outer camps to burn. And that was the solution, the first part of the complaints. The second part doesn't do that at all. And note, they're not the only ones complaining. Who else complains? Moses. In verse 11, Moses says, "Why have you done evil to your servant? Have thou found favor in your eyes that you place this burdensome entire people upon me? That I conceive them? That I give birth to them? You said he carried them in your bosom, and a nurse carries a suckling child to the land that you swore to your forefathers. Where shall I get meat?" So the people complain, Moses complains. What's God's solution for Moses? Not yet. Yeah, Moses' solution is helpers, 70 people. And what's the solution for the people's complaint? Quail. As well as death. Now, not death of everybody, but death of some of the people. Why did God show kindness to Moses in this instance, but not necessarily to people? What are they complaining about? That's why. What are they complaining about? The people are mad that God brought them to this miserable place and supposedly to take care of them, and yet, what do they get? Moses. Who's innocent. Moses is an innocent bystander. They're taking out Moses. The people are complaining to God, or to Moses about God. People complaining about God. What's Moses complaining about? The people. Which one do you think God has more sympathy for? Moses and the people. Because God has been dealing with complainers his whole existence. Since Adam and Eve been around. Complain and complain, complain, complain. God can relate to those who have to suffer complainers. Not so much the ones who are complaining. In this instance, God obviously helps Moses because he knows his people are too much. Now, I don't know who all the 70 men were. It rattles off two of them. And the two that it does rattle off that he selects were not part of the ones brought to the tent of meeting. But they were included in the name count, which means at the tent of meeting, when Moses goes and gets these 70 people, there is Moses himself plus 68 of them. Are there at the tent of meeting for the distribution of the Spirit of God and put upon these men. Two of them are remained in the camp. Now, traditionally, no one knows why, by the way, but traditionally they specify the two of them remain in the camp probably due to humility. They wanted to be humble. They didn't feel necessary to go up. That's the tradition. And they were still rewarded with the Spirit of God being put upon them. God didn't put a sin on them or wasn't angry with them, as he had done previously in other instances where people raided in the camp of the leaders. It's possible. We don't know all the reasons of why. It's just tradition as to what the reasons they raided in the camp. But either way, God still included them. So those two men were included too. So Moses gets his 70 helpers, which is helpful, at least. I'm not sure how many, who got in charge of what, but at least he got 70 people to distribute some of the work. And the people get quail. Now, because Moses couldn't understand how God was going to do this one. Got quail for a whole month. Now, it specifies they got quail for days, journey all directions around the camp when the wind came through. And so they spread out their quail around their campsite. So some of them died with the food still in their mouths, their teeth. They were still chewing it. I don't know how many or who. I can take a wild stab at it. It's probably the riffraff, the rabble-rousers that started the craving. At least some of them. Not necessarily all, but some of them. Yes, Jaron.
You just didn't thank God for the quail.
Didn't think it's possible. There is tradition, a belief that people were so craving the animal that they didn't cook it. They just ate it raw. And that is a tradition. There's zero proof of it. It's just a tradition. And which would kill most people if you eat raw animals, if they're not, particularly if you're not accustomed to it. And I don't know where quail have been, but they poop a lot, so I couldn't imagine it be very tasty. So quail, some of them got death, but only some. They were the people who died didn't get the 30 days of eating meat, did they? Everybody else who didn't die got 30 days of eating meat. God could have killed those people before he brought the quail. He could, like he did with the fire, burn the edge of the camp, he could have killed them off. He chose not to. For what purpose? Why did he use this method to kill them versus any other methods he's used in the past? Most of them just kind of strike dead. But, or Korah, is, you know, earth opens up. He used this method to do one task, one thing in particular. Exactly. To prove that he could do it. To demonstrate all you people who are complaining, to demonstrate to them, hey, here, look, God could do anything. Once you've seen it, now off of your head, so to speak. now you grasp the concept of how powerful God is. Now I don't need you anymore, go away. So use that for some of them, I don't know how many, but everybody else gets to eat for about a month. Good for them. Of quail. Hope they enjoy it. I don't have time for this. The last complainer for this section of our reading is who? Miriam and Aaron. Does God like complainers?
No.
Oh. What's Miriam and Aaron's complaint? In particular, Miriam, because she's...
They give you in charge.
It says, Miriam and Aaron, this is chapter 12, spoke against Moses regarding the Cushite woman he had married. For he had married a Cushite woman. Now, Moses, at this time in history, is roughly 82 years old. Now, he has been married up to this point to Zipporah, who was from Midian. She was a Midianite. Now, Midians get wiped out later on, but recall, I think it's Balaam, he's from Midian, is really the predicted. They are descendants of Abraham. So Midians are all Abraham's descendants that he had with Keturah, his second wife, after Sarah had died. So Midian's from Abraham. Zipporah's from Abraham, the Midianites. I don't know who, you know, Abraham, I don't know anything beyond as far as their genealogy. They've been married for, most have argued, they don't know precisely, about 40-ish years. They say that because Moses goes into Egypt at the age of 80 to go back to bring Israel out, and it says he leaves Egypt while he's still 80. So basically it's 1 year he's in Egypt with all the plagues and then all the various mishaps happen down there. He's there in Egypt for roughly, at least, it could be a little less, but no more than 1 year. Now, he's in the second year, the second month, second year. He's at least 81, could be 82 by now. Hard to say. I don't know his birth date. Doesn't say. So whatever his birth date was, either 81 or 82 on his exact date. Zipporah was only in Egypt when Moses went down there the first time. She didn't stay for all the plagues. It specifies that, that later on, after come out of Egypt, a year ago actually, when they're at the Mount Sinai, so about 9 months earlier, Zipporah and her children all come with Reuel and Hoav, Jethro, they all come and they're reunited with Moses. So his family's reunited about 10 months earlier. I don't know if Zipporah's still alive or not. Doesn't say. But either way, they're reunited about 10 months earlier. So at this point in the story, Moses gets married to a Cushite woman. I don't know if Zipporah's dead. I don't know if it's a second wife. None of our business. The point is, he's married again, and she's complaining, in particular Miriam, about the Cushite woman. What's the complaint? What's wrong with the Cushite woman? Any ideas? Go ahead.
The weird thing about it is that they say they complained about she married a Cushite woman, but we never read why. Did she not know how to cook? Did she not? We have no
idea. What's wrong with her?
Which
right.
makes it suspicious that they were using her as an excuse then to turn around and attack Moses outright as saying, well, why does God talk to him? Or why is he only around? Because you never read about anything other about the Cushite woman other than the fact that she had married Moses.
Right.
Maybe she was a bad cook. Maybe she didn't know how to clean house.
She didn't know how to cook well.
Didn't know how to cook well. That could be a problem. So he marries a Cushite woman. She is not from the tribes of Israel, though. Now, keep in mind, Aaron has to marry within the tribes of Israel. Man of leadership has married the tribes of Israel. Note, up to this point, a lot of mixed multitude has come out of Egypt. It's all of Israel, plus a mixed multitude of everybody else. The various slaves of this and the cultures of that have all come forth. They're all big, mixed up group. I'm going to guess, since Cushite or Sudan, or Ethiopia, I think it's Ethiopia, it's very, very close to Egypt. She probably came through the Red Sea like everybody else did, along with a mixed multitude. Probably. So she probably has lived through this, and she sees the same stuff. She sees the same smoke of the mountain. She hears the same noises, and she sees all the same things that Moses does. She's probably gone through this cycle, too. She's been probably around for at least a year, year and a half, and went through as well. He chose her to marry, but she's not an Israelite. Now, it's possible, I say it's probable, that Miriam's straw, which is a straw complaint, that it's because she wasn't an Israelite. Versus, he could have chosen any one of the ladies of Israel to marry. He chose somebody who was outside. To me, in my own personal thinking, he was right to choose outside. But that's my own personal thinking because I look at it differently than I think Miriam's doing it. Choosing outside of Israel symbolically does something. Moses is likened unto God in how he's acting, his actions, as far as he was likened to God, as it specifies and says so explicitly, that God was going to make Moses like a god or like God in Pharaoh's eyes, which of course was all of Egypt's eyes too, which means the Cushite woman too, and all of Israel's eyes too. He's like God. That isn't God. He's not actually God, but he's likened unto him. He has the same authority, the power, the strength is all there. So he's likened unto God. If Moses had chosen someone within Israel, his Midianite wife was not within Israel, no other wife he chose in Israel. Was it within Israel, it would almost be like a preferential treatment. That's my own personal thinking. The reason I say that, and I say it on purpose, is because when Messiah comes along, his bride includes who? Everyone who calls on his name. Is it just Israel? No. It's purposefully not just Israel. Is Israel included? Yes. But it's not just them. So in this symbolism that Moses is representing God, Aaron was supposed to represent the Messiah in most instances. But in this process of including Cushite woman, to my thinking, it is similar to how Messiah and Moses are tied as well. See, Moses, though he represents God to Israel and to Egypt, the process of going through Red Sea, the process of delivering people of Israel through their trials and tribulations, that is a messianic role. That's Messiah's job, not God the Creator's job. God the Creator did a different task. He has a drawing people toward him. Messiah's role is to deliver people through. So though Moses represented God to Pharaoh, Moses represents Messiah to everybody else, to anyone who believes in him. He represents that personification, that example, that identity. So he's representing this person. He's going to marry or bring in everybody. And it was valuable for him to have married a Midianite woman and married a Cushite woman, neither of which are from Israel. It brings an all-inclusive little bow on the presentation as far as what Messiah is supposed to do. So bringing those characters in, that's valuable to me in my thinking. It's just my opinion. Now it points out here in verse 3, Moses was exceedingly humble more than any other person on the face of the earth. Sounds real humble, doesn't it? By the way, who's writing this? Moses. So, chisel, whatever. I'm exceedingly humble. The most humble. I won't argue how humble he was or wasn't. Apparently, according to the Torah, or however it's written, it says he was the most humble on earth. It's not by mistake. In Hebrews chapter 3, it indicates a similar concept. Hebrews chapter 3, it says, therefore, brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle and the high priest our confession, Jesus Christ, who was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses was faithful in all his house. For this one has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, inasmuch as he who built the house has more honor than the house. Every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. Moses indeed was faithful in all his house as a servant, for a testimony of those things which would be spoken afterward. But Christ as a son over his own house, whose house we are, if we hold fast the confidence and rejoicing of the hope firm to the end. In this example of Hebrews, by the way, to be exceedingly humble and yet wield the great power Moses has in talking to God face to face in a conversation like a friend, which is beyond amazing. He has the great power to do that, and yet he's exceedingly humble. Does God grant that to everyone? Does God grant that to any normal person? No, he's not. What does the term faithful mean? Trust. Trustworthy. Moses is trustworthy. So you have faith in something because you trust it. So Moses is trustworthy in all of God's house, according to the book of Hebrews. So Moses' humbleness reflects his trustworthiness. He's not taking the glory of all this power he wields and says, it's all about me. Well, he does do one mistake, but we'll discuss that later when he hits a rock. That's a mistake which he pays for dearly for. He's a very trustworthy individual. A very faithful person, very humble person. So Messiah is the only other person compared to him, and Messiah is greater. So if you see the humbleness of Moses, you're seeing the humbleness of Messiah. You've seen the trustworthiness or faithfulness of Moses, you've seen the faithfulness of Messiah. The trustworthiness is there. Now the difference being, of course, in Hebrews, Messiah is in fact the son. He's the owner of the house. God's ability, Messiah owns it. Moses is the one who's the servant, the one who's in charge. So he's a very trusted servant. This complaint against him being exceedingly humble, not the humble it's a complaint, but that he is exceedingly humble implies he's exceedingly trustworthy. You would trust somebody who is truly humble. Now, humble does not mean cowardice. We all understand the differences, right? What humble means versus what coward means. A humbleness is within your home, within your personal life, you understand the difference between what is within your strength and power and what is not. And what is not is none of your business. It is outside of your realm. It's outside of your power. It's outside of your authority, outside of your right. That's how you were humbleness. Now, Moses, on the other hand, when it comes to people breaking God's laws, was he humble? Yes. Was he firm and strong? Absolutely. See, humbleness has nothing to do with being firm or strong. It has to do with how you apply what is yours and what isn't yours. That makes sense? Okay. So Moses is humble in his life and how he lives his life. He is not weak in how he handles God's affairs. What would you expect Messiah then to be? The Son of God. Equally, if not greater, humble, but even more, less weak when it comes to how he's handling God's affairs. Now, Moses was very firm in these people, but he's also very compassionate. He prayed for them, called out God, hey, help this person, they're dying, the plague of this, the plague of that. Very wise, very humble, but very firm. Okay? So that would deal with those issues. One thing I want to jump to, I want to end here today. It's getting late. We're hot and tired. We're going to jump to not all of it, but just part of it. 1 Corinthians. See, Moses' goal for all of Israel was not to dominate them. It was not, the goal wasn't to have Levi be in charge of everybody. That you go back to Levi to do all this stuff, or any of that nature. That wasn't his objective. What is Moses' ultimate objective in this whole process? Get them to promised land. Get them what they are rightfully theirs. Now, we discussed this previously. What is truly God's promised land? Heavenly Father, heaven up there. That's his real promised land. So Moses' goal, though it's a physical form here in the book of Numbers, the spiritual concept is to get the people from wherever the mess they're at up into a true promised land, which is the Father's promised land up in heaven. How does he get there? What methods is he going to have to take? Well, he's talking to God and trying to lead and discussing going back and forth with laws, live this way, live that way. Don't do this, don't do that. I want to bring your attention back a few chapters in Numbers, back to the event of all those people who were prophesying. There were 70 men who were prophesying. I'm going to abbreviate. Plus two who were left to the camp that were also prophesying. What was the reaction of the people in the camp? They ran to Moses.
They ran to Moses, and I took it as because these guys shouldn't be prophesizing.
And why is that? Why would they think that?
Because they think prophesizing is at the end times.
It's possible that that may be what they're thinking. In the eyes, we mentioned a few minutes ago, the eyes of all of Israel, as well as most of Egypt and half the world at this point in time, Moses is likened to God. He has great strength, great power, yada, yada, yada. When you have a question, an issue, a problem with your neighbor, or something about God you want to ask, you go to Moses to get the answer. He has all the answers. He's the answer man. He's got it all. If another person comes along and says, well, I have answers too, what's the natural reaction of people? Who are you? All right, I see Moses doing all this work. He's talking to God. God's talking to him. I hear strange noises and thunderings. And who are you now? What are you prophesying? What are you claiming to be? Are your words from God? Are they from a demon? What are you? Now, they're coming from Egypt, which has multiple gods, multiple groups of gods, I do different things, and priests up the wazoo. They have a whole bunch of stuff going on down there, and as far as this is, yeah, this is nothing more. Oh, look, it's a repeat. Remember the golden calf? Look what we need. We don't need a division of this. That's their philosophy. That's their thought process. Note, also in Egypt, Pharaoh considered himself a god. It changed as far as how many years and what god it was, but they changed a lot of the lifetimes. But Pharaoh considered himself a god-like figure. So he was the authority of all stuff. Well, also the people are going to look at Moses and say, okay, I'm accustomed to seeing Pharaoh for the last couple hundred years as being a godlike figure. Now you must be our godlike figure. Anybody else is a peon. Not important. Ignore them. But now you have somebody in the camp saying, well, wait a minute. I can speak in tongues or whatever is offering. I don't know what they're doing. But they're prophesying something, whatever it may be. So Nak's reaction was that are these two men, as in Joshua said, incarcerate them. They were assuming these two men, as well as 70 for that matter, are rebelling. Because they're doing something different than Moses. Different than Moses said to do. Why? It's confusing to them. Is that Moses' goal? To teach people to follow him? What's Moses' goal? To teach them that they all will be like those men. All be thoroughly trustworthy, thoroughly faithful in God. That's his objective. So what would we expect if that was Moses' goal? Is that also Messiah's goal? Well, yes. To every man, woman, and child is trustworthy in God. In the same way that Moses was, or the Messiah was. So, of course, in this process, which allowed them to do this, they were not, in fact, rebelling, but rather, they were expressing that it said it only happened this once, it didn't happen again, so we don't know how long this lasted. Maybe it was a day, could have been a couple hours, I don't know. They're all prophesying. They got this technique or this tool from the Spirit of God. That's what it is. So the Spirit of God comes along the people, and that's what it's doing along these named 70 men. Because what is Moses' goal? As he explains to Joshua, that all of Israel would be prophets. All of Israel would declare and understand God and be at one with him and prophesy and talk this way. I'm going to jump to 1 Corinthians chapter 12. I'm not reading the whole thing, just part of it. Now, concerning spiritual gifts, brethren, I don't want you to be ignorant. You know that you were Gentiles, carried away to those dumb idols, however you were led. Note, that's what they were afraid of, by the way. People were afraid of being led in a different direction. Being led different than what Moses is. They also already went, they probably refreshed their memory of the golden calf, too. Therefore, I make known to you that no one speaking by the Spirit of God calls Jesus accursed, and no one can say that Jesus is Lord except by the Spirit of God. Now, there are diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit. These are differences in ministries, but the same Lord. The diversity of activities, the same God who works in all. But the manifestation of the Spirit is given to each one for the profit of all. For to one is given the word of wisdom, the Spirit, to another the word of knowledge, the same Spirit. So the faith of the same Spirit, to another gifts of healings, the same Spirit, to the working of miracles, to their prophecy, discerning of spirits, to the different kinds of tongues, and the interpretation of tongues. But one and the same Spirit works all these things, distributing each one individually as he wills. For as the body is one, many members, but all members of that one body, being many, are one, so also Christ. For one Spirit we're all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, and all have been made through the same drink into one Spirit. For in fact, the body is not just one member, but many. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the ear say, because I am not an eye, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where would the hearing be? If the whole body were hearing, where would the smelling be? But now God has set the members, each one of them, in his body, just as he is pleased. And if they were all one member, where would the body be? But now indeed there are many members, yet one body. And the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you. Nor again to the head of the feet, I have no need of you. No, much rather those members of the body which seem to be weaker or necessary. Those members of the body which we think of less honorable, on these we bestow great honor. And our unpresentable parts have greater modesty. Our presentable parts have no need, but God composed the body, having given greater honor to that part which lacks it. That there should be no division in the body, but the members should have the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all members rejoice with it. If you are the body of Christ and members individually, God has appointed these in the church, apostles and prophets, teachers and miracles, gifts of healings, helpers, administrators, and varieties of tongues. Is everyone an apostle? Is everyone a prophet? Is everyone a teacher? Is everyone a worker of miracles? Do all have gifts of healing? Do all speak in tongues? Do all interpret? Earnestly desire the best gifts, and yet I show you more an excellent way. This explanation, as far as given in chapter 12, each one of these men had a gift. Whatever the gift was, is a prophesying. What they were saying, I don't know. But this prophesying was a distributed gift. So the Spirit of God was giving these men the ability to prophesy. Whatever it was, I'm not sure. Prophecy. Spell it wrong. That prophesying is essentially words. They're saying something. They're declaring something. What are they declaring? It's coming from God. So they're declaring God's words. Now, they don't retain this prophecy. They don't retain this ability forever. It's a temporary thing. So this gift from the Spirit of God was a temporary gift for these men. But what was the function? What did it accomplish to the people of Israel? When they saw this, the 70 men, well, 68 plus two in the camp, all 70 men prophesying, what does it explain to the people who are watching? What does it show them? It shows God's power, and also shows that there is more than a single person here. There's more than a single entity we're dealing with. There's more than just Moses. It's more than just Aaron. It's more than just Miriam. It's bigger. Once you realize something's bigger than that, it includes you. That's a big deal. You now feel included. The guy is prophesying, oh, I know him. He's my grandfather. Oh, he's not like Moses, but look, he's prophesying. I know him. You feel an attachment, or he's my cousin, or so. You are included. You can attach yourself. Yeah, from all the tribes, you can attach yourself to this. You can identify a personal connection to this individual. It's no longer Moses over there in the tent that I'm not allowed to go near, or up in the mountain that's too dark and I just stay away from it. It's now right next to you. The person next to you. It brings a very personal approach, a personal concept between you and God, which was Moses' goal. That's the goal. To bring us into heaven is a personal attachment, a personal connection with God. So we started out with this reading today. We started out with the Levites. The Levites' job was to be the intercessor between the people and God. Like a better term, a barrier, a separator, a divider. But by the end of this cycle of how they went through wanderings, how they went through complainings, by the end of it, what are they getting? The division isn't quite so strong. The concept of this massive barrier of Levites are there, and I'm only to approach them and never go near. The Spirit of God being distributed about the people outside the Levites, amongst the children of Israel. Now you have, see, this barrier is just a physical barrier. There's spiritual content that's far, far bigger than this. It's stronger than this. So we're from one extreme of don't go near God, at least we'll die, to God came to us. And now we can talk and communicate. It's that idea behind it, which is how we work from one step to the next, getting closer and closer to God, which is Moses' goal. Does that make sense? Any questions or comments?
I like the way that... I just like what you said. I mean, that just makes complete sense that the 71 people besides Moses... I mean, they like you said, it could be somebody's grandfather, somebody's uncle, somebody's father. I mean, they're all... And these people will know all these people. And it does, I mean, just really brings them all close in the unity that would form.
It does. It's a very, very personal relationship shows up because you know the person. It is amazing. It's a change of concept and feeling and a spiritual idea of what's happening.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hillel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hillel.info. That's HALLEL.info. hillel.info.